Welcome to Cross Examining Cyber, a podcast brought to you by Herbert Smith Freehills. In this podcast series, we explore all things cyber, including the legal, regulatory, and policy developments that impact corporates around the world. We look at the evolving cyber risk landscape by speaking to those people who are on the front line, protecting companies from cyber incidents and shaping the legal and regulatory environment. I'm Cam Whitfield, a partner at Herbert Smith Freehills and leader of our Asia-Pac cyber practice. In this episode, we talk with Bill Siegel, CEO of the first incident response company, Coveware. Coveware works closely with clients to guide them through cyber extortion attacks, including negotiations with the threat actors themselves. Bill and I could have talked for hours. Luckily for you, we did not. We did have a far-reaching conversation dealing with the Coveware business, the ransom business model, threat actor negotiations, and the value of data in enabling effective threat actor response. We've divided this podcast into two. This is part one in our cross-examination of Bill Siegel. Thanks for joining us. Bill, where does this podcast find you today?
I'm on the east coast of the United States in Connecticut, just about an hour north of Manhattan.
Must be a nicer time of year, surely, over there at the moment. Moving into warmer climes, I'm sure.
Getting there, not quite there yet. Hopefully in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, good stuff. Hey, before we start talking about the sort of the landscape and what you're seeing and what Coveware is seeing, it'll be great to get a little bit of background just about your career path, Bill, and also just some background about Coveware as a company. It's an organization which has become synonymous with sort of reputable first responder type work. I'm sure that sort of reputation doesn't come overnight. So I'd love to hear a little bit about you, your career path, and then also how Coveware came to be.
Yeah, sure. So I spent, I guess, the first half more of my career in the regulated financial services industry, both like the investment management side. And then after the credit crisis, was 08, 09, I guess, I stepped away from Wall Street and decided to kind of try my hand in the startup space and the technology space. And first company I joined failed after 3 years. Next one I joined sort of had a mediocre, outcome. And then was the CFO of a company called Security Scorecard for a bit that gave me my first taste into like the cybersecurity landscape. And it was after that company that I got back together with Alex, who's my co-founder here at Coveware, and we started kicking around ideas. Alex was at a company called Datto, which is a kind of a big player in the backup disaster recovery space. And we started circling around this kind of the issue of ransomware. And what struck us initially was for something that's as large of a problem as it seems to be, nobody has any good data on it, right? Which just struck us as odd, right? It's like if you had some major problem that was affecting society, cars crashing, medical problems, we would be studying the data down to its atomic level to figure out what the issue was and how to fix it. And here we have this problem of ransomware, and the best data that's out there is, a bunch of surveys that are sort of hypothetical and subject to bias. There's no first-hand collected data. So we figured, well, we don't really know what we want to do yet, but if we find a way to collect high-quality, first-hand collected data about how these incidents are happening, that's step one to solving the problem. And we'll figure out a business model somewhere around there. And so that's what we did. We didn't really know what we were going to do. We just launched the company and we ended up sort of kicking around a bunch of ideas, some stuff that wasn't really working for a little bit until we stumbled across this kind of concept within incident response that no one seemed to be focusing on, which was handling negotiations on behalf of companies that had had been attacked and were experiencing a cyber extortion threat. And we didn't know anything about negotiating when we started the company. We read some books, and we figured the data would speak to us after a while, and we'd be able to, you know, infer and draw conclusions from the patterns. And that's really how everything got rolling. It's kind of snowballed from there. We're coming up on 6 years now. But that's really kind of the origin story of myself and how Alex and I founded the company.
It's a great point you make around the lack of data in this space. And I'm sure you're aware of this, here in Australia, we're going through a bit of a discussion about legislating in this space. And I know it is a global debate, I guess, going on about whether or not we outlaw or at least make unlawful the payment of ransom. And it's a rather simplistic way of dealing with a very sophisticated problem. Outlawing ransom payments does not actually solve or what the resilience issues that we face. It's just looking to deal with a particular part of that sort of business model. But we are at risk, I think, of legislating around this in a void or a vacuum of information or based on survey results or anecdotal evidence. So it's interesting to have an organization like yourself leaning so heavily into the data space here in Australia, or at least that the proposition is to actually make it ransom payments at the very least something that's reported on a mandatory basis.
Yeah. I mean, we are big fans here and have been for a long time of the benefit of reporting. And if anything, you know, in the United States, it's been frustrating by the lack of like a holistic and standardized reporting framework, like at the federal level. I'm often sort of jealous of, I'm sure, you know, in Australia, everyone has their own frustrations with the government, but should know that in America, we look very enviously at how quickly sometimes you can legislate things down in Australia because we can't even keep the lights on sometimes in the United States with our own federal government. But there's a couple really strong benefits to reporting that everyone's like, oh, reporting, it's so boring. It's like, what's it actually do, right? Like, well, number one, like, if you do it properly and you implement it properly, you can collect firsthand the data that, you know, we sought out to collect and we are collecting. And you could standardize it. And you could actually get your arms around the problem rather than not actually knowing what's going on. It's number one. And number two, there's like a moral hazard component to how these attacks play out. As you well know in your work and your practice, that, you know, 5-6 years ago, companies really approached this as like, can we keep it quiet? Can we avoid reporting? Do we have to tell everybody? And there's a lot of that has gone away, but there's still a good chunk of it where companies believe they can keep these things quiet. A lot of the payments that occur today wouldn't occur if there was just that single trigger of a mandatory report, because a company wouldn't want to pop up on a radar. Wouldn't want to have to explain themselves. And it shows you just how kind of how superfluous and potentially unnecessary those ransom payments are if something as simple as, well, you have to report the government would be the sort of the factor that leads the company to not pay. And I think that, you know, we're not talking about cutting off 50% of the payments out there, but I don't think it's unreasonable to expect that, you know, somewhere between 10 and 20% of payments may not be contemplated or occur if the victim organization knew that they had to really holistically report to a regulatory body all of the nitty-gritty details of the incident.
It's a great point, and quite frankly, it's not something that is a point that's never really raised in the public debate, and certainly in the debate that we've had, it's been rather simplistic, which is about getting information, not the byproduct or perhaps an unexpected benefit of reporting, which is that it puts reputation front of mind and actually deals with the issue through reputational stress, if I can put it like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, here in New York, we have, in the U.S., I'm sure you're aware, we've got state regulation, federal regulation, NYDFS, who, is a bit of a polarizing regulatory body, because some of the things they do are good, some of the things they do are a little less popular, but they put in place a reporting framework, pieces of which I thought were really, really good. One of which was, if you are regulated by NYDFS and you experience a ransomware attack and you pay a ransom, you actually have to actually tell them why, explain to them why you had to be able to reiterate a thesis or why it was necessary. You can't just say it happened and here's the dates, and here's the amounts. Like, you have to tell them why. I think that's great, right? If you really need to pay, it's going to be an easy thing to answer. If you really didn't need to, it's going to be very hard.
I'm going to jump around a little bit, Bill, only because the way in which you're taking the conversation leads us into perhaps one of the more tricky issues. And rather than sort of pick it up later, I thought we'd pick it up now. I'm a big follower of your blog, and I recommend that to anyone that's interested in this space. It comes out regularly and it gives you excellent insights into things like payment trends and the like. Can I ask you what you're seeing in this space in terms of payment trends, irrespective of what we're seeing in the law or when it comes to reporting? I know when I and no one sort of asks really to be in this business, do they? They sort of find themselves here in many respects. But when I was 4 or 5 years ago, I had a sense that many organizations were paying, but nowadays that doesn't seem to be the case. I'd be fascinated in your view.
Yeah, it is certainly over the past couple of years, while the volume of attacks has gone up, the percentage of companies that actually end up paying is going down. And it's attributed to, there's a couple factors. The Colonial Pipeline incident here in the United States was a really big wake-up call to enterprises really all over the globe, but here in the States, especially about, I think a lot of the executives viewed it as the way the executive team of that company sort of got marched through the halls of Washington and frankly shamed.
Mm-hmm.
And shame, as we know, is a very powerful emotion. A lot of executives at other companies said, well, that's not going to be me. So I need to open up the budget to my security team to make sure that that's not me, because I don't want to get marched in front of Congress and Senate like that. And so it had a very positive impact on security spending and the right type of security spending. Specifically on, the defense side, preventing these things from happening to begin with. And number two, ensuring that if these things do happen, you've got viable backups that you can recover from very quickly to minimize business interruptions so that you don't shut down all the gasoline on the East Coast of the United States. So we really saw a kind of a big shift in outcomes after that. And frankly, we saw a shift in the corresponding shift then, because every action has a reaction. The threat actor has shifted as well, because they realize, well, encrypting data isn't as successful anymore. So we're going to start stealing more data and trying to extort companies for that. And even on that front, we've seen less and less companies succumbing to paying threat actors to what we don't call it to prevent a leak, because that's actually not true. Data has been leaked the moment it was stolen. Paying to suppress it from getting basically posted on a leak site. Less and less companies are doing that these days because they're realizing that you don't actually get anything in return for the payment. All your notification obligations, regulatory, civil, whatever, lawsuits, all these things are going to happen anyway. Turns out the threat actors don't delete your data. That's been proven in the most recent LockBit takedown when law enforcement went in and realized victims that paid didn't pay and all the data was still sitting there. And there's also it's kind of a safety numbers thing. Where, 3 years ago or so, when the Maze groups really pioneered this, lots of companies were just like, well, I'm the only one on this island. I'm not going to be the only one on this island. Now it is it's completely diluted. Nobody is paying attention to the latest company that's posted on leak site. No one cares anymore. It's not news. These breaches happen often. And so there's sort of a safety and, well, it's happening to everybody. It happened to me. It's regrettable. But we'll do the right thing. We'll notify the people that we need to notify, and we'll make our amends, and the sun will rise tomorrow.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you're not exactly going to get a deed of guarantee from a criminal threat actor or some sort of NDA when you go through this process. And it's a great point to note that you do not get any sort of regulatory benefit from a payment, but nor do you get any sort of guarantee. It's fascinating, isn't it, when you look behind the curtain of Lockbit and see everything still sitting there. We talk a little bit about what you're seeing in terms of the model or the extortion or the criminal model. As you know, or as we all know, that things move from encryption to encryption and data theft and the double extortion, and then some organizations have just had data theft alone. Some of them have had that because of perhaps good luck, not good management, really, in many respects. But what are you seeing on the front line in terms of the evolution of that sort of criminal model?
Yeah. So, I mean, what we're seeing now is like this, it's kind of cyclical, right? Like what's called ransomware as a service, and for the listeners that don't have the pleasure of knowing that is just like software as a service, except it's ransomware as a service. It was essentially a business model that was conjured by some of the cyber criminals who realized that they could make more money not by just attacking companies on their own, but by creating a brand of ransomware, controlling basically all the tools that other affiliates would need to carry out their own attacks, and essentially running a kind of a back-end administrative and support service infrastructure, and then only taking basically enabling lots of other cyber criminals to carry out lots of attacks, and then the owner of that brand takes a small cut. They can make more by taking that small cut than by carrying out attacks themselves. And this got really, really big in 2020. And then some of the very directed law enforcement takedowns that happened sort of weakened the model and got a lot of those groups a little bit afraid of law enforcement action against them. And so they sort of, it kind of waned a little bit, and the affiliates spread out, and then the Russia-Ukraine war broke out, and that caused a little bit more mixing and shuffling. But it built back up again. And then you had groups like Lockbit and Black Hat that became like very, very prolific and quite brazen, frankly. Oftentimes just, daring governments to come after them. And very recently they did. There was a big breakup and takedown of Lockbit and some corresponding sanctions and similar things happening to Black Hat. And now you can sort of feel that all the people that were working for those brands have now started to spread out again, and are sort of branching out, doing their own things, trying to behave as lone wolves. At the end of the day, the model that these groups are doing, it's just a question of like how much work the underlying threat actor has to do, right? It got very easy for them when the ransomware service groups were doing almost all the work for them. Now it's a little bit harder. It's a little more work. You have to be a little more technically skilled, but you get to keep all your money yourself. The reality is defending yourselves against these groups hasn't changed at all, actually. The methods of ingress, the vulnerabilities that they're exploiting, it continues to just be a kind of live off the land, whatever is cheap and easy they're going to do. Doesn't matter how prolific the ransomware service groups are or not. Defending yourselves against these, these people, these groups is frankly, it's almost like the security industry's product marketing makes it sound very interesting and scary and different, but it's not. At the end of the day, it's actually incredibly repetitive.
And I'd be interested in your view. I suspect often quite simplistic, notwithstanding suggestions that certain attacks might be highly sophisticated or highly organized. Getting into an organization can sometimes be a frighteningly easy thing to do and to have happen, really.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's like, now it is scary how well capitalized some of these groups are getting. And it is true, and it happens from time to time that some of these groups will actually, you know, participate and pay for, you know, 0-day or O-day vulnerabilities. And that's a scary thing because, you know, like a ransomware group competing with nation states to buy vulnerabilities for hundreds of thousands of dollars or more is a kind of a scary prospect. But that's really like an edge case. Most of the time, we're talking about known vulnerabilities with known CVEs that are unpatched and pretty standard, you know, compensating controls that could prevent the vast majority of these attacks that were just not implemented at the companies. So, you know, that is, you know, I would say more than 80-20. It's more like 95-5 in terms of like the attacks that we see are, we're not seeing new and novel things.
Bill, you mentioned Ukraine and the conflict in Ukraine. We've also got a highly complex situation unfolding in the Middle East at the moment. What's your take on the geopolitics and the influence that changes in geopolitics have in this space?
Yeah, so I mean, they certainly get mushed together, but from our perspective, it's very easy to tell the difference between a financially motivated actor and a non-financially motivated actor. They behave extremely differently. And so there are groups out there that are non-financially motivated that employ some of the same tactics and maybe even employ ransomware, but their motives are disruption and damage versus money. And it's actually quite straightforward to tell the difference, not just because of their brand or whatnot, but the way they behave is extremely different. Financially motivated actors will do the least amount of work for the most amount of money. So it's obvious that that's the way they're behaving. So really the main impact that all the, you know, geopolitical shifts that we've seen over the last 2 years has had is that it's frankly, it's like it has disrupted the sort of fiscal safe harbors of a lot of these actors, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, right? Before the Russia-Ukraine war, there was some, I mean, it wasn't a lot, but there was some cooperation on the Russian side on law enforcement. Once the war broke out, that's for all intents and purposes for our lifetimes, that's probably over now, right? You can consider that state as a pure safe haven for cyber criminals. They're not going to be arresting anyone, even though here and there you might hear things about occurring. But at the end of the day, what's important to realize is these are people and this is their business. They're not all diabolical, you know, sociopathic cyber criminals. In fact, by count, most of them are probably much more similar to you and I. They have relatively normal lives. They just can't make the living that they want to make working a legitimate job in the part of the world that they live in. And they are technically skilled and they're desirous of more income. And so they're willing to take a little bit more risk and participate in this illicit industry. But then these geopolitical conflicts come about and actually physically disrupt them, right? They're not safe where they were. They have to move. They have to go somewhere else. And that causes friction and disruption to themselves actually physically. But it is an important point that, like, listen, there's some diabolical, you know, pure criminal, you know, masterminds out there, but most of them are actually somewhat normal people that are just like, I have to do this because it's the only way to make money. And I don't really care about stealing from some, you know, rich companies in Australia or the United States. So this is what I got to do.
Interesting you say that, isn't it? Because desperate people sometimes do desperate things. But we look at the Russia-Ukraine conflict, highly educated, STEM-educated individuals, for example, in Ukraine, looking to not just survive but thrive in an economy which is suffering. So it's a great point. Can I just take this geopolitical discussion, sort of flip it on its head and ask you, when you look across your clients, across the different regions in the world, are you seeing any particular trends that can be regionalized? I mean, we often hear, clearly in Australia, we hear a lot about what's happening here. We have a reasonably good handle about what's happening in the US and And arguably, it's heading in a slightly different direction than it is here. But to be frank with you, we often hear very little about what's happening in Asia or through Southeast Asia or other parts of the world. Where are you seeing pockets of activity like this? And are you seeing different trends within different geopolitical locations or different locations?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the trends have to do more with like the kind of cultural proclivities of the companies and the executives that run those companies. So, you know, like at its most basic, there is a very big difference between like kind of just Western European companies and US companies. Western European companies are much less concerned about like having very tight, what we call recovery time objectives, right? Like in the US, it's like got to be back up in 30 minutes. It can't be down for that long. And in Europe, it's much more like, well, as long as we don't lose any data, you know, we can restore and our customers will understand, you know, we'll get back up and rolling. And frankly, that's helped, I think, a lot of European companies actually have much safer backup and continuity infrastructure because they segmented more because they're okay with a longer recovery time. One of the things that happens with backups is the faster you need to recover, the more likely you are to move your backups closer to where you need them.
Yeah.
Then the security tends to sort of crumble because you make sacrifices for the sake of speed. Yeah. And that's what happened in the United States is they say, oh, well, we got to be back up in this amount. Well, the only physical way to do that without bending the laws of physics is to locate the backups right next to the server it's backing up and have no firewalls, no segmentation between the two. And guess what happens? That guy finds both of them because they're right next to each other and they wipe both. So I think like a lot of the differences are at least in outcomes and how like these attacks goes starts with like just how culturally different the executives are and what they're pressured by and what they're not pressured by, and how that trickles through their enterprise and the decisions they've made about security and preparedness, and all that ends up sort of playing out in the incident. And, you know, that's why Western European companies tend to not pay ransoms as much because they don't need to, because they very rarely are without viable backups.
And what about sectors? I often get asked about particularly vulnerable sectors. Do you see that, or is it more opportunistic, less predictable around different sectors? And we see statistics come out, and sure, once you get into a reportable state, you are able to make a correlation between an incident and a sector. But there's a difference between that and actually a sector being targeted. So, what are you seeing in terms of sector specific targeting? And can we actually draw any conclusions based on the data in relation to sector vulnerability?
Yeah, so targeting is a hard word to get around, to get away from, because it just, unfortunately, it works so well in sentences when you're talking about these attacks, right? But the reality is targeting is too expensive for any financially motivated actor to actually do, right? If I'm like, oh, I'm going to target this sector, but there's no easy vulnerabilities there, I'm never going to make any money because I can't get in because it's too hard. So targeting by its very nature is too expensive for financially motivated actors to actually practice. So the way the sort of pie chart ends up getting broken out is which sectors are actually economically attractive to attack. And that ends up being just the sectors that aren't patching, aren't secure. And so, you know, you typically see, for instance, about, within professional, just like, you know, B2B professional services tends to be overweight attacks versus its overall percentage of businesses that are out there. And it's because there's a lot of, small, mid-sized CPA firms, financial advisory firms, some small law firms that just don't pay attention to security. And it's not because bad guys are targeting them because they don't like, lawyers or accountants. It's because their environments present themselves to the internet in a vulnerable way, and that's why they end up getting impacted. So I think when people's like, they're targeting this or they're targeting that, nation states, not financially motivated actors, they target because they don't like something, or they have a motive, or they have an objective, intelligence, IP theft, whatever it is, right? You want to steal, nuclear secrets, you got to target the nuclear sector, right? But that is not what financially motivated actors do. It is too expensive. Economically, it doesn't work.
Thanks again for tuning in to Cross Examining Cyber, a podcast brought to you by Herbert Smith Freehills. In our next episode, we continue our cross-examination of Bill Siegel, the CEO of Coveware. The conversation continues, and don't forget to tune in. Thank you again, Bill, and thank you all for listening.